Before long come the arrests. Since these protests first began in the summer, British police have arrested more than 2,000, charging hundreds under terror laws in a move the demonstrators say is to stifle dissent against the UK's complicity in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians.
They've attempted to use terrorism legislation to remove from all public discourse the one body of people in this country who, as citizens, have stood up and put their bodies on the line to materially interrupt an economic, military, and diplomatic collaboration in genocide.
Palestine action was prescribed by former Home Secretary Yvette Cooper in June this year. Membership of or support for the group is punishable by up to 14 years in prison.
The government is complicit in the genocide in Gaza, and they will do anything to criminalize any resistance against it, including old people sat with signs saying, "I oppose genocide."
In an unprecedented move in British history, Palestine Action is challenging its prescription in this court starting November 25th in the form of a judicial review.
If the High Court votes in favor of Palestine Action, the thousands of arrests and the hundreds of charges that were brought against demonstrators like these under the Terrorism Act of 2000 will also be quashed.
A victory for Palestine Action would also have repercussions for its jailed members, six of whom are now on an open-ended hunger strike in prisons across Britain. Saipur is in London.
Israel has struck a residential building in the heart of the Beirut suburbs. The third and fourth floors of a nine-story building were badly damaged, with debris filling the road, damaging cars and property. Deputy head of Hezbollah Political Bureau confirmed to Press TV that a senior commander was targeted in the strike.
This is an attempted assassination, targeting a key leader within the resistance. What matters now is that we document this as a clear act of aggression, an escalation we cannot and will not tolerate. It is our responsibility at the national level to establish a response that confronts Israel's attempt to undermine our sovereignty.
Although the Israeli statement said the target was a commander in the resistance, people near the scene say Israeli strikes are targeting everyone.
I am from this neighborhood. Every time they come up with this claim that they are targeting a member of the resistance, we are all members of the resistance. I want to tell our prime minister, who was a judge in the international court, if your diplomacy can't protect us and solve our crisis, then leave us to be and don't speak in our name. And this mechanism is obviously biased towards Israel.
Alice believes the Israeli claims that Hezbollah has rehabilitated is merely preparing the ground for a larger escalation and a U.S. green light for this aggression.
This marks a new level of violation, and there are two potential outcomes. Either the resistance retaliates, which would escalate into a full-scale war, or they absorb this blow, which could embolden Israel to carry out further strikes. Both options are devastating. This is a turning point. With Israel seeking to normalize its escalation in Lebanon, backed by U.S. support, and with the Lebanese government failing to take action.
President Joseph Aoun called on the international community to intervene firmly to stop Israeli attacks on the country. Lebanon, he said, reiterates its call to the international community to assume its responsibility and intervene firmly and seriously to stop the attacks on Lebanon and its people. The Israeli strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut and the U.S. blessing are considered part of the growing pressure by both sides to enforce full surrender by Hezbollah and full compliance of the Lebanese government to disarm the resistance. However, many believe that this opens the way for different scenarios, especially if the resistance decides it is time to retaliate. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In September this year, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced his government's plans to introduce mandatory digital ID for all British citizens by 2029. The announcement sparked fury across the full spectrum of the British political landscape, uniting forces who would otherwise disagree on pretty much everything else. The digital ID's plans have led to continuous protests, with thousands braving wintry weather conditions in London on Saturday to express their opposition to the plans.
We're here to protest digital ID. We're also here to make the point to people that they're already being tracked, they're already being surveilled and controlled by systems beyond their knowledge or control. And this is just an extra step. And this is almost a way for the government to act like we're giving our consent for them to track us. But they're doing it anyway.
The main justification given by Starmer for the rollout of digital IDs is to help the government's crackdown on illegal migration, leading to suspicions that the so-called migrant crisis was allowed to develop to then justify these types of draconian measures in response.
A massive fear that many Brits have is that the digital ID plans, in combination with a rumoured ban on the use of cash in the future, portends the creation of a dystopian AI-powered control grid where every move you make is subject to surveillance and censorship by the state in real time.
These protesters believe that enough of the country is opposed to the digital ID rollout, but that for mass non-compliance to become a realistic prospect, unity across the political spectrum is a must.
Anybody organising anything can be controlled by this. So we want everyone to unite in common cause. As you say in our leaflet here, Palestine and freedom fighters, indeed everyone, unite in common cause.
The British state has long wanted to introduce digital IDs, going as far back as when Tony Blair floated the prospect when he was Prime Minister in the 2000s. But with mass opposition already forming and one of the most unpopular governments in recent history at the helm, opponents are quietly confident in their chances of defeating the entire idea altogether. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Ukraine's European allies are holding talks on the sideline of the G20 summit over Trump's proposed peace plan to end the Ukraine war. In a joint statement, they described the proposal as unilateral, saying that it requires additional work. They expressed concern over the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to future attacks.
The war can only end with Ukraine's unconditional consent. Wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries involved. Rather, this is a war that can only end with Ukraine's consent and with our consent, the consent of the European Union, because it is a war on the European continent.
Kiev has also rejected key elements of the plan. The Ukrainian president's office said the country will never be an obstacle to peace, but emphasized that its representatives would continue to defend the legitimate interests of the Ukrainian people. President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice. Either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner. We did not betray Ukraine then, we will not do it now. And I know for sure that in this truly one of the most difficult moments in our history, I am not alone.
Neighboring Poland also expressed firm opposition, insisting that any peace agreement must be accepted by Kiev and that Ukrainians themselves must have a central role in negotiations. The White House has denied that Ukraine was sidelined, but skepticism in Europe remains high. Trump, meanwhile, has escalated pressure on Kiev, warning that Ukraine would lose additional territory in a short amount of time if it refused the plan, and declaring that Zelensky is going to have to approve it.
Well, he'll have to like it, and if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting, I guess, you know.
The U.S. president said he had given Ukraine until Thursday to agree to the plan. According to widely leaked drafts, the U.S. plan includes several concessions Ukraine has previously ruled out. These include recognizing Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk as de facto Russian, obliging Ukraine to constitutionally renounce NATO membership, and reducing Ukraine's armed forces to 600,000 troops. Additional provisions would bar NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. The text also outlines steps for Russia's reintegration into the global economy and its return to the G8. For many European governments, the episode has exposed a far deeper worry. A peace plan drafted behind closed doors, unveiled as a near-final document, and built around sweeping concessions to Moscow, has intensified the sense that Washington under Trump is no longer behaving like a dependable ally. European officials say the administration bypassed NATO entirely, kept key European capitals in the dark about provisions that directly affect their own security, and excluded Ukraine, the country at the center of the war, from any meaningful role in shaping its terms. For Europe, the episode is a blunt reminder that under Trump, the United States is prepared to act unilaterally on matters central to Europe's security, even if its closest allies are left entirely out of the room.
Yemen's health minister Ali Shayban paints a stark picture of a health system suffocating under siege. Medicines are vanishing, chronic patients are deteriorating, children are dying before help can reach them. He called the shutdown of Sana'a International Airport a crime against humanity, especially after Israeli strikes destroyed its capacity, cutting off the only viable route for life-saving drugs. Families now face a brutal reality. No airport means no treatment, and no treatment means lives lost.
Today, we renew our call for the United Nations to operate flights and reopen Sana'a International Airport to save thousands of patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. More than 250,000 patients require medical travel for serious and life-threatening conditions. Over 1,330 types of essential medicines, including immune therapies and other critical drugs, have not been allowed into the country due to the air blockade.
The ministry says thousands have been deprived of essential medications due to the air blockade. It warns that inaction would cause more deaths that can be simply prevented.
The continued closure of Sana'a International Airport clearly proves that the international humanitarian and health organizations that constantly preach about human rights are fully politicized and operate under American and Israeli influence. The clearest example is what is happening in Yemen, where thousands of people urgently need to travel for treatment but remain unable to do so as the airport remains closed to this moment.
Israel struck Sana'a International Airport in early May this year, damaging its runway, terminal, and several aircraft. The regime struck the facility again as Yemen continued its military operations against Israeli targets in response to its war on Gaza. Yemen's health ministry says the reopening of the airport, once a lifeline for the population, is an urgent humanitarian obligation, not a political convenience.
The health crisis continues to escalate as life-saving medicines remain blocked from entering the country. Officials warn that unless urgent steps are taken to restore medical access, thousands of vulnerable patients will face worsening conditions with no alternative options. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The latest U.S. jobs reports paints a bleak portrait of the American economy under President Donald Trump. Newly released data showed the unemployment rate climbed to 4.4% in September, its highest level since October 2021, signaling a labor market losing momentum. Industries once considered pillars of the American economy are faltering. Transportation and warehousing shed more than 25,000 jobs, while manufacturing lost another 6,000 positions. The report itself was delayed for weeks due to the government shutdown, a disruption triggered by political brinkmanship in Washington. Its release now lands alongside troubling inflation data. Manual inflation in September reached its highest reading since January, confirming that prices are accelerating at their fastest pace of the year. Economists point to one major culprit behind rising costs: Trump's aggressive and increasingly erratic tariff regime. Since returning to office, he has slapped steep import taxes on goods from dozens of countries, including long-standing allies. Instead of reviving American industry, the tariffs have pushed production costs upward and left consumers footing the bill. Trump had promised Americans that prices would fall on day one of his presidency. Instead, a clear majority now report that their expenses have surged. Despite Trump's repeated insistence that there is virtually no inflation, a new Harris poll shows Americans continuing to feel financial strain and growing more pessimistic about the economic direction of the country. The data underscore their frustration. The typical American household now spends $208 more every month just to purchase the same basket of goods and services as a year earlier, and more than $1,000 more per month compared with early 2021 when the nation was emerging from the pandemic. Now, many analysts believe that if the Trump administration continues doubling down on these policies, the financial pressure will only spread. Higher prices, fewer job opportunities, and a shrinking margin of stability for millions of households already stretched thin.
Family, my neighbors and my friends, standing firm together against oppression, holding hands. It doesn't matter where you're from, or if you're young or woman or man, we're here for the same reason, we want to take back our land. Just to be free, just to be free. Now when we've taken our first step towards a life of complete freedom, we can see our dream getting closer and closer. We're almost there. Oh God, thank you for giving us strength to hold on. And now we're here together.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, poor but generous. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Shreya with me, Sister Zainab. And so the title, Poor But Generous. And you know, look, this is something that we, I think many of us have actually noticed. And it's we almost have sayings about this, that, you know, we often see that the poor people are so generous. And then by contrast, you know, these are sort of stereotypes. And then people sometimes say, well, you know, the wealthy people will get so wealthy because they're not so generous. You know, maybe it's not totally fair to say that, but for sure, there are some instances where we can really see that sort of thing unfolding. And I immediately always think of, for example, our wonderful pilgrimage of Arba'een, where we in Iraq, where we see that some of the poorest people in Iraq are literally preparing almost a whole year, saving up so they can host and provide for all the pilgrims during Arba'een. And, you know, and it is like that in some of the poorer communities. They will literally give, you know, the best thing they have to when they have guests coming around. And so obviously what I should even start with the thing I would say at the end of this of a little recording, and that is that, you know, this is what Islam wants from us anyway. When we're giving to people, Islam loves that. Obviously, we should be, first of all, considering our family, our sort of close and sort of other relatives and our neighbors and friends and travelers, the needy, the orphans. And we should be generous, and we should give of the best. So we shouldn't just, just give a little. If we've guests around, yeah, for sure, we should make sure that we provide something really good for them. And if we're giving in charity, that we give really good quality things. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being Shreya with me, Sister Zainab. And also, so I'm talking about this idea that obviously we've got the poor people who are very generous. And I've been talking about the fact that when we do give, whether we're hosting people, whether if we're guests, or whether we're just giving in charity, we should be generous. We should always give the best. But I also wanted to just mention something about the life of one of the famous martyrs from Home Defense by the name of Sayyid Jan Bozorgi. Now, he, for example, didn't have much money. And so he had been to, he'd gone to Karbala, I think with some other members of family. And he'd actually brought back for all the women in the whole family scarves. And he'd also brought back shirts for all the men. And, you know, for someone who, and this is something that people will do, you know, if we've gone on pilgrimage somewhere, whether we've gone to Mashhad, whether we've gone to Iraq, we've gone to, you know, Najaf or Karbala, if we've just gone traveling somewhere for a holiday, often we like to bring presents back, whether it's just for our immediate family, let's say a spouse, you know, parents, or if we didn't go with the children because the children are older, then maybe for the children or other friends or even neighbors. And so this is typical behavior. But, you know, when we don't have much money, to still then bring back such a, what can I say, a wonderful sort of assortment of presents is quite beautiful. And this is just a reminder that, yeah, you know, this is, in Islam, obviously it's something very good that we give presents to our fellow believers, because we're told that this is one way to sort of strengthen our ties with our fellow believers, with our brothers and sisters in Islam. So it's, it creates stronger bonds, and for sure it also just puts smiles on people's faces. It makes them feel good, because when people, for example, if people bring back presents for us, we feel really happy, because, you know, it's not even about whatever we're given. It's just the fact that the other person is considered us. So if we haven't been practicing this thing that we bring back little things every so often for our friends and family, maybe it's something we should sort of institute just as a normal thing to do, because obviously it strengthens the ties with our friends, with family members, and it just adds to that sort of general feeling good anyway, which is something that we should promote in our societies. Essentially, this is just a reminder for all of us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Iron Brings Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. We start this hour's lineup with leader's speech. The program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Then it's time for a spotlight. The program covers the most important events happening in the world today with roundtable analysis and discussion. And our final program this hour is our varied radio productions feature.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hazrat Fatima alayha salam is the role model for women throughout history and for all. Referring to the qualities of Hazrat Fatima alayha salam, Ayatollah Khamenei says, "A multidimensional human being, a brave warrior in the way of Islam, a knowledgeable lady who at the same time played her role as a housewife and affectionate wife and mother to perfection. Such was Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam. Her life was very simple and she had very frugal needs or expectations. Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam was the best exemplar for all women and Muslims should learn from her. Hazrat Zahra alayha salam proved that like men, a woman too can reach the most sublime levels of ethics and worship on the mystical path. The very existence of Hazrat Zahra alayha salam, along with her skills of eloquence, her political and social expertise and powerful foresight, demonstrates how a Muslim woman can attain high spiritual and mystical positions at a young age. Role model such as this great personality, Muslim women should never feel weak or helpless, but should in fact gather more awareness about the high status that Islam grants to women. A study of life of this great lady would clearly show us that the path to ascension is wide open for every woman. In fact, it is Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayhi salam who has already trodden that path and is a guide for other women to follow. Hazrat Fatima was like a bright light in the lives of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is natural that taking her as a role model would be very beneficial for Muslim women. Declaring the birthday of Hazrat Zahra alayhi salam as Women's Day, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "If you don't learn from her asceticism, piety, modesty, and other virtues, you have not even understood the true essence of womanhood." Hazrat Fatima alayha salam was a very knowledgeable person, a fact that was acknowledged by friends and foes alike. In fact, from time to time, she would make herself available for people who needed answers or clarifications on difficult and complicated issues. Her sermons, poems, and sayings are evidence of her intellectual strength of character and nobility of mind. She was an embodiment of all virtues of womanhood. She was an exemplary daughter, a loving and supporting wife, a caring mother, and a powerful and aware member of the society.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done
joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Israeli regime continues to cause death and destruction in the region. On Saturday alone, 20 more Palestinians were killed and almost 90 others injured in Gaza. And on Sunday, the regime attacked the southern part of Beirut in Dahiya and killed 5 people and wounded 28 others, including 10 children and 8 women. Both in Gaza and Lebanon, the Zionist entity has ceasefire agreements. Well, while these agreements have guarantors, they simply look the other way as the agreements continue to be violated on an almost daily basis in both places. So what is the meaning of an agreement for the regime and its Western backers? And what is next for the region? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ali Hani, military strategic affairs analyst out of Beirut. Saad Nimr, professor of political science, Beirut University, out of Ramallah. Thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Beirut. And Ali, I mean, since November of 2024, when Lebanon and the regime agreed to a ceasefire, many Lebanese have been killed by the Zionists. I mean, does the regime actually think that it can destroy the resistance with such attacks? Or what is behind this, in your perspective?
Greetings to you and to your guest and all the audience. Let's say that the 1701 agreement and the 20 points deal of Sharm el-Sheikh regarding Gaza, both agreements are gone with the wind because the Israelis does not recognize such announcement or agreement, and they still violate them. Let's take Lebanon now. Since 27/11/2024, about a year exactly, up to now, about 10,000 violations against Lebanon, 335 killed, and more than 900 injured in Lebanon because of the Israelis' aggression against Lebanon. And what's amazing in this situation, that who is supposed to be the guarantor on mechanism committee to implement, to control the implementation and to observe the implementation of 1701 resolution, which is announcement of cessation of hostilities between Lebanon and the Israeli entity, is the same. This guarantor is the same who always given the green light to the Israelis to have aggressions against Lebanon. So I think the head of this committee, who is within, he's working within the UNIFIL forces in Lebanon, he is given the permission to the Israelis to attack Lebanon from time to time, at any time they need it, to kill as so-called, you know, a golden goal or golden target for the Israelis to kill in Lebanon or to commit assassination. Mm-hmm. So I think General Clearfield, the head of this mechanism, is only controlling Lebanon not to have even a word against the Israelis. We have Rodolphe Haykel, the Army commander, Lebanese army commander, once said that the Israeli enemy, they make a big issue out of it, and that Lebanon should not call Israel as an enemy, but Israel attacking Lebanon, killing the innocent and the civilians, and destroying the infrastructure is okay with them.
Okay. Interesting points. I mean, Saeed, let's pick up on what Ali has just said about the guarantors of these agreements, actually, both whether we're talking about Gaza or we're talking about Lebanon. Your take, do you feel that the guarantors are actually in some ways allowing the Israeli regime, that the regime actually serve as its proxies because they're not saying anything, they're creating situations to allow this to continue to happen? I mean, how do you see that, Saad?
Good evening to you, Mrs. Hashimi, and to your guest from Beirut, and to all your viewers. Well, I think that Israel is trying now to implement a new kind of policy in the region, whether that is in Gaza or even in Lebanon, which allow them to take action whenever they wanted and to assassinate whoever they wanted and to bombard in any way they wanted. And this is coming today after 2 days of the president of Lebanon said that he's willing to start negotiating. And this is the answer from Israel, is to continue to do that. They are not interested. I think that what they are interested in is to provoke Hezbollah in order to resume the war on Lebanon and to make sure that this time there will be a huge devastation, and that would help. Generally, they think so, that in this case, the people in Lebanon will say to Hezbollah, that's it, you have to put down your weapon. The same situation, more or less, is in Gaza. In Gaza also, they are trying now to provoke the Palestinians, and in order to, because of the what they've been doing in the last just month and a week after the signing of the ceasefire, more than 370 Palestinians were killed. So this number is very, very high in comparison. And remind us within the days before the ceasefire itself. So they are resuming war here and there, and they want to implement this new rules in the area that they have, in spite of the ceasefire agreement in both areas, in Lebanon and in Palestine. They are saying that we are committed to, but in spite of this agreement, they continue with these atrocities, and they consider it as something from their point of view, and agreed with America also, that it is allowed to Israel to do so. This kind of the understandings between Israel and the United States, that they are will be allowed to continue, you know, bombardment here and there and assassination here and there when it is necessary from their point of view. And because of that, they are continue to do that. And this is the policy that they want to implement in the area, in spite of the ceasefire agreements, which was guaranteed in both sides with the countries and the United States itself and other countries around.
Well, Andy, in your perspective, what is Israel's ultimate goal with these attacks in Lebanon? I mean, is it an intimidation type of project to make sure that Hezbollah never responds, to put fear in the people, to try to put pressure? Is it to eliminate Hezbollah? I mean, how do you see it, the regime's ultimate goal right now with these attacks that's almost happening on a daily basis now?
You know, before I go for explanation, let's say it briefly. It is a war of pressure for to subjugate the Lebanese negotiators in case they want to go into the negotiation table, which I believe now it's not anymore in the in the Israeli interest to have any negotiation with Lebanon, as long as most of the Arab countries are going for normalization or for Abraham Accord. Syria is totally dismantled, divided into now there are five Syrias Maybe in another couple months, it will be 10 or 15 Syrias. I'm talking about Syria 1, Syria 2, Syria 3. So that's what Israel is aiming at. They don't care anymore about any negotiation with Lebanon because they believe they can use their tools in any way, from anywhere, and they are using up to now, not military, but they are using the whole Arab media. I'm talking about the countries that are under the Abraham Accord or under the normalization, even though they didn't declare it, but they are into it. All the media are against Hezbollah, against Hamas, against the resistance, against the Palestinian cause, against Palestine itself. They don't want to take on their shoulder anymore and carry the Palestinian cause to retrieve the occupied land to the Palestinian. And some of them are coming now on TVs, and especially on Al Arabiya, to say that this land, that this land belongs to the Jews and not to the Palestinian historically, and they're trying to kill with the with their help. They're trying to kill the truth. Also, the truth. Also, they want to kill the geography and the history of the region. So the only two unswallowable big bites in the region still. I'm not talking about Iran or Pakistan or Turkey. I'm talking about the surrounding countries. We are talking about Hamas, especially Hamas in Gaza, or let's say especially Gaza, not the whole area, because the Palestinian Authority are in their pocket right now, in the Israeli pocket, and they are some kind of puppies or muppets. So the only two unswallowable bites in the region are Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. So they want to use their most powerful tools inside or outside through the Arab world or through the determination of every country to go along with. I'm talking about Abraham Accord.
Okay.
So in this case, will have fire, heating the fire, and some kind of corrosion inside each country. And this is in Lebanon and Gaza up to now. We still can resist such way of pressure and subjugation.
Okay. Well, Saad, I mean, today, as you know, the capital, Beirut, Dahiyeh, was targeted, heavily populated residential area. Do you think the Zionist regime has decided that it wants to enter a full-scale war with Lebanon and the resistance, or how do you see it?
Oh, yeah, yes, absolutely, but under conditions. I think that the Israelis are not going to enter Lebanon or to occupy parts of Lebanon on the ground war, but rather they will use their air force and their bombardment. That's how it is. They put Hezbollah, however, in a very awkward situation after today's assassination. Either Hezbollah will retaliate, and in this case, Israelis are preparing for a massive attack on Lebanon and to resume the war, even if, as they said, for a few days maybe, but still, they are going to use their air force and their bombardments to make, you know, to inflict this kind of a huge destruction in Lebanon in order to make people, you know, go against Hezbollah. And on the, if Hezbollah did not retaliate, it means that Israel now have the upper hand to do whatever they want in Lebanon, whenever they want, regardless if there is a kind of negotiations or not regarding the ceasefire and the withdrawal of the Israeli troops from Lebanon. So I think that what happened today is very, very, important kind of a milestone in the relationship in the region. And for Hezbollah in particular, Hezbollah till now did not even announce what's going to happen. They are waiting even to announce about the assassination officially. And after that, they said, we will study the situation. They are in a very, awkward situation. If they retaliated, it means that Israel is preparing a massive attack on Lebanon and a huge destruction without even entering the borders of Israel, apart from the areas that they are in today. But if Hezbollah did not retaliate, it means that, Israel will get it, that Hezbollah is weaker now, and they can't do anything about it, and we can do whatever we want in Lebanon whenever we want. That's the problem that Israel is creating now in Lebanon.
Your thoughts, Ali. I mean, what are Hezbollah's options right now? How do you think that it will respond to what has taken place today?
Well, let's see first who is the number one enemy and who is the agitator of such war against Lebanon. We all remember the massacre of the pagers in Lebanon. It was American hand, totally American hands behind it, not the Israelis. And we all know that gospel system that been introduced to the 8,200 unit in Israel to penetrate Hezbollah through the electronic warfare, not the cyber warfare. And now we know that for a month, we all know, and we talked about it on the news, that the MQ-4, MQ-9, U-2, and Compass Call, and they are all intelligence, observer, surveillance, multi-role, UAVs and drones, American. I'm talking about American. And we can see that they gather all the information to give it to the Israelis after the Israelis went over Lebanon with the Squadron 122, and this is equal to AWACS airplanes, and they could not find any new target in Lebanon. Now we see that the Israeli failed again against Lebanon intelligence-wise, but the American helped them again and again. And I heard it today, the Speaker of the White House said that most of the information in the hand of Israel are coming from the United States. Now our war is not against Israel, is against United States, and in this case against the NATO, against the Western Hemisphere. So how to retaliate Hezbollah, how can be able to retaliate? It should be very carefully studied, and it should be maybe starting liberating the 5 points in Lebanon occupied by the Israelis, or starting shutting down the drones.
Okay. Well, Saad, what about that, what Ali has just said? I mean, it's really not about the Israeli regime alone, and it has never really been, but it has been the whole Western hegemonic front, whether we're talking about Gaza or whether we're talking about Lebanon. I mean, isn't this the reality that the resistance in general is facing? And what does it mean, as Ali said, that an American official openly admits their involvement? And we know that Trump, many different times, and what he has said about the U.S. involvement in Gaza and then not being involved, contradicting himself. I mean, your thoughts.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We know that. And that's why now in the international community, if you like, it should be a kind of a new kind of set in the world. We are talking about China and Russia, India, and some of the South American countries, some African countries. Now I think it's part of the whole thing, and this is one could be of the last battles for the Western atmosphere, atmosphere in against the East and South. I hope that will be, because now I think things are quite clear. We rely on the people in Europe and in America to rise again, because now it became obvious after ceasefire and after doing all that, yet Israel is continuing its atrocities against these people. That will make it clear that this country is a country that threatened the whole peace in the whole area, and it is not Hezbollah or Hamas or others who are trying to liberate their countries from such aggression and from such occupation. So we had to focus on this now more than any time, any other time, among the people who are standing and used to stand with whether Lebanon or Palestine in all of the Western Hemisphere. At the same time, it's a call for really those Arab and Islamic countries now to start thinking about their relationship and their kind of you know, even economic relationship as well with which countries, and to sign and to be with the side of the other countries like China.
But let me just
Iran.
Jump in here, Saad. You're talking about the Arab countries, but we've also been talking about the number of more and more Arab countries that seem as if they want to be part of the Abraham Accords instead of supporting the oppressed of the region. So where does that leave us? Let me throw this back to Ali. So, Ali, with what you're saying, that it's all of NATO, or as I call it, the whole Western hegemonic front, that is actually, whether we're talking about Lebanon and many would say even Gaza, that it's a battle of the whole front. Do you think that in response to what is happening, let's say the increased attacks now on Lebanon, that it's going to take the whole resistance front together to counter the whole hegemonic front? I mean, how do you see where this is going at this point in time?
I think this is one of the options, to gather all the resistance ally front against the Israelis, the American, the state of normalization in the region, and also in the Western countries. But the problem is we have no confidence in our neighbors along, because what happened during the aggression and the genocide against Gaza, all the Arab countries surrounding, especially the Abraham Accord countries and the state of normalization, they helped Israel not only by supporting the entity with food and with medicine, with